Hey, this is the 2012 Winfield Bible School. The overall theme for this school, that we may know him and the power of his resurrection. Our brother speaking for this class is our brother Stephen Hornhart. The title for his series is Come and See, Witnessing for Christ. This is class number 5. The angels prepared themselves to sound the first wind trumpet. There was no reading for this class. Brother Steve?
Thank you, Brother Tim, and good morning, my beloved brothers and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ and, of course, our dear young people. Very nice to be with you once again as we, as Brother Tim has said, we commence our fifth class this morning, and the particular topic, as we have on the screen, and the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. Now, brethren and sisters, this eighth chapter that we're going to be considering both this morning and tomorrow morning, notwithstanding the amazing detail and notwithstanding, brothers and sisters, the richness of the drama that is presented in this chapter, nevertheless, there is an amazing, wonderful encouragement that comes out of this chapter. And that encouragement is this, is that all of these events that take place in both chapter 8 and also swinging into chapter 9 are the direct result of God's response to the prayers of the saints. And that is so, so very encouraging. And so we've already had it, with, of course, in the fifth seal in Revelation chapter 6, where our brothers and sisters cried from under the altar, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will this go on?" And that, of course, was then answered as the sixth seal came and the great earthquake shook the world, and that Edict of Milan was issued in 313. Respite to our brothers and sisters, albeit brief, nevertheless the answer was there. And similarly, we find in this chapter, all the events that take place are the answer, God ever listening to the prayers of his saints. And so we pick up the record, of course, in verse 3 of Revelation chapter 8, and we read these words. "And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer." Now, there are two altars in this verse, brothers and sisters. So here we have in verse 3, an angel comes and stands at the altar of burnt offering, at the brazen altar. "And he had a golden censer in his hand, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of the saints upon the other altar," of course, which was the golden altar, which was before the throne. Now, brothers and sisters, we need to understand what John is seeing. We need to get the picture of what he's seeing. He sees an angel walk over to the altar of burnt offering and scoop up these coals and take that fire and spread those coals on the altar of incense. And as he did that, he would then flash the incense onto the altar of incense, and then the incense would go up to Almighty God. And when that incense touched the nostrils of God, then we read in verse 4, "And the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand." And soon as that happened, the angel took the censer, filled it with the same fire. So the fire that ignited the prayer, the fire that inspired the prayer, was used, brothers and sisters, and hurtled back to the world. That is a swift, effective, powerful response to prayers of brothers and sisters. What a wonderful thing. And so as we go through these events, keep ever in mind that all of this event that took place historically, the power of these kings, the power of these nations, were moved by angels because brothers and sisters cried to God. That's how powerful our prayers are today. Don't think that when we pray to our Heavenly Father, he can't move mountains, brothers and sisters. He moved them all right, as we shall see. In fact, there was one mountain that he moved, and it was ripped out of the ground and thrown into the sea and set on fire. That's how powerful prayer is. Now, what I want to do this morning, before we get too much further into our studies, and something that will form a basis, brothers and sisters, well, actually, We want to look at a chart over here that will form the basis, and it will show us how important some of these things are in Revelation chapter 8. Because what we see with respect to what we've done thus far, we've tracked very quickly through these first six seals. And as we've tracked through them, we've seen slowly but surely the demise of the pagan Roman Empire until it was rolled away in the first great earthquake. But now we move to chapter 8 and verse 1, and we open the seventh seal. And as we open the seventh seal, brothers and sisters, we see now that the seventh seal would contain these seven trumpets. Now, in our remaining two studies, we want to have a look at these last four trumpets. So this morning, we're going to be looking at the introduction as the angels prepare themselves and look at the first wind trumpet. And then tomorrow, God willing, we're going to finish off our studies by looking at trumpets 2, 3, and 4, and then wrap up our series with some very exhortational comments as to why all of this information, all of this detail, all of this drama we have considered, why is it so important to you and I to look back hundreds of years into the past? Why is it relevant to you and me? Why is it important that we at least have some understanding of these things? And we'll look at that, God willing, tomorrow in our last study. However, what we want to do this morning as a springboard into opening up chapter 8, particularly chapter 8, we need, brothers and sisters, to get our head around this important contrasting link between the end of the sixth seal and the beginning of the seventh seal. There's an amazing contrast and a link we need to get our head around. Now, to help us getting our head around this link, this contrast between the close of that seal and the opening of the last seal, it would do us well just to do a little revision and also then to use this chart as a springboard into chapter 8. So over our studies thus far, brothers and sisters, we've got these dates up here, 312, 313, 324, 330, and 337. Dates that some of us would be very familiar with. However, what we've considered over the last few days together is that we know that Constantine came into Rome in 312. He beat Maxentius, and so now Constantine is in fact the ruler of the West, only the West at this stage. He is ruling in Rome. Two other emperors are yet to be dealt with, Licinius and Maximin. We also know in our studies that in 313, the answer to the prayers of the saints came in this wise, that both Constantine and Licinius would come together and issue the Edict of Milan, temporary respite to our brothers and sisters. But of course, all of these years that roll by from 312 through to 324, brothers and sisters, this was the chaos that existed as the earthquake was gathering momentum, until finally, here, right there on that line, was the end of the sixth seal, and right there on that line was the beginning now of the seventh seal. Now we have Constantine, who is ruler of both East and West. Constantine is the ruler of the world. The world now has become Christian. What Constantine then did was in 326 AD, due to the fact that Rome was vulnerable to the barbarians, Constantine in 326 moved his capital to Byzantium, which would in 330 be renamed Constantinople. And then, as do all men, in 337, Constantine dies. Now, brothers and sisters, this section here, from the end of the sixth seal to the beginning of the seventh seal, 324 is a hallmark. And this area here, from 324 through to 337, is a period of 14 years. That is a very important time period, as you will see in the outworking of this eighth chapter. So, over here there is chaos. And brothers and sisters, over here we're introduced in Revelation chapter 8 and verse 1 to silence. And so therefore, we then read in Revelation 8 and verse 1, we read these words. And we're going to come back to that chart, we're going to leave it up there, and we're going to see the relevance of those dates from 324 through to 337, that 14-year period. So, in Revelation 8 and verse 1, we read these words. And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven, in the political heavens of the world. Previously, there had been chaos in the political heavens of the world leading up to AD 324. Now there is silence in the political heavens about the space of half an hour. Now, brothers and sisters, we've got to capture what John sees. Understand this, that John has just witnessed that. And he's had his pen out. He's been watching all of these activities, and as his pen is skipping across the parchment, he can see a sun go black, and he writes it down. And then he sees a moon turn to blood, and he writes it down. He sees stars crashing to the earth, and he writes it down. He sees dragons drawing the third part of the stars of heaven, and he writes it down. He sees hurricanes ripping off figs, and he writes it down. It is awfully active prone, brothers and sisters. The color is vivid, the noise is deafening, and the activity is frenetic. And there is heart-stopping stuff going on here, let me tell you. Was John perspiring? Well, I think I would be as I was writing this. And all of a sudden, brothers and sisters, as John flips his parchment over, ready to write some more things, all this drama that's going on, all of a sudden it goes, woof! And there's nothing. Absolutely nothing. His pen's poised. He's waiting. He leans forward. He can't hear a thing. There's nothing. Stone silence. And there's the contrast between chaos and silence. And as he leans, brothers and sisters, he's waiting to write, but nothing. A minute goes by. 2 minutes go by. 3 minutes go by. And as he turns around, he sees in this stone silence seven angels like that. And in their hands, brothers and sisters, these seven angels have got seven trumpets. Can you see the contrast? In stone silence, there are these seven angels with seven trumpets. And I tell you this, brothers and sisters, by the time they put their trumpets, each of them in turn, to their lips, block your ears, John, there is going to be an ear-shattering blast as each trumpet is blown and judgment successively now comes upon the Christian empire in turn. What an amazing thing, brothers and sisters, with respect to this. Now we need to just get our head around this section of this silence in heaven in contrast to the chaos. There is the result, we might say, of the angels which blow their trumpets, particularly the four wind trumpets, which we're going to have a look at. Now, when you look at that map there on the screen, we've got there the Western Empire begins to be eclipsed, particularly and more accurately, begins to be eclipsed in 476 AD. But here is a map that shows the barbarian kingdoms of 526 AD. And when you look at that, that is the end result, that is the end result of the events of chapter 8 of Revelation. That's why the angels have blown their trumpets. Now you look at that map there and you go, where are these great Christian Catholic emperors of the Western Empire? Where are they? They're not there. Oh, I can see Visigoths. I can see Franks. I can see Burgundians. I can see Ostrogoths. I can see Vandals down there. There is no Western Roman Empire. It has been engulfed by barbaric kingdoms. Oh, well, the Roman Empire is over there in the east. That's still intact and would remain so for another 1,000 years or so before the Turks in 1453 would then bring judgment on that eastern part. But there, brothers and sisters, is the effect of Revelation chapter 8. Now, we need to get our head around this section here of there was silence in the political heavens with the rule of Constantine as the sole emperor over the world and then until the time that Constantine dies. Now, this probably would be... No, I won't say that because that'll set the scene, and you don't want to set scenes if you don't want the scene to be the way you want it set. So there's no setting of scenes, if you know what I mean. If you haven't had coffee, that won't mean anything to you. Coffee probably may help or it may not. All right, brothers and sisters, we have Revelation chapter 8 opening, and Revelation 8 opens with this sentence. There was silence in heaven for about the space of half... Now, political heavens, we're talking about all the political events that took place over and there in the sixth seal, and this spins over into the seventh seal of Revelation 8. Now, John listens. He hears nothing, and there is silence for this half an hour. Now, let's just for a few minutes explore this time period. Let's make a statement as we endeavour to show this to you. The first statement that we make, brothers and sisters, is we try to unravel what this half an hour means. A half an hour. What does that mean? Is it literal? Of course it's not. It's symbolic of a time period. How do we extrapolate that? Well, we know there are 12 hours in a Jewish day. I don't have to say that. The Lord Jesus Christ said that, because in John chapter 11 and verse 9, Jesus said, "Are there not 12 hours in a day?" So in a Jewish day, it started at 6 a.m. and it concluded at 6 p.m. And then there were 12 hours in a Jewish night from 6 p.m. through to 6 a.m. We'll also read, for instance, in Luke 23 and verse 44, "And there was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the earth until the ninth hour." How are you going there, Tim? Can you see around this whiteboard? I can't. I'm having trouble. Let me just move this out the way. All right, that's better. And we read these words with respect to Luke 23 and 44. It was about the sixth hour, midday, taken from 6 a.m., the beginning of the Jewish day. So midday, there was darkness. And we know that our Lord Jesus Christ died at 3 p.m., the ninth hour. So these two verses substantiate that there are, in fact, 12 hours in a Jewish day. We're heading to try and figure out what this half an hour means. Now, that being the case, we therefore, brothers and sisters, know that 1 hour is 1/12 of a day. It's pretty straightforward. Extrapolating further on, we therefore can conclude, and rightly so, that a half an hour is 1/24 of a day. That's pretty straightforward as well. A half an hour is 1/24 of a day. Alrighty, now let's apply, as we do with the apocalypse, a day for a year principle. And we have got many quotations that substantiate that we can use this day for a year principle to determine time periods in the book of Revelation. Genesis 47 and verse 9, Jacob said, "The days of the years of my life." We also know that in Numbers 14 and verse 34, Israel wandered in the wilderness 1 year for each day that the spies spied out the land. We also know that Ezekiel, a man of sign, was asked to lie on his side for numbers of days, representing the awful calamities that would befall Israel. A day for a year. A lovely quotation in Luke 13 and verse 32, where the people came to Jesus and said, "Herod is after you." And Jesus said, "You go and tell that fox that I must work miracles and cure diseases today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected." And Jesus spoke of those 3 days representing the 3 years of his ministry. So whether we look at the Old Testament or whether we look at the New Testament, we have justification for looking at a day for a year principle. Let's apply it now to this half an hour where there was silence in heaven. If 12 hours in a Jewish day is a fact, which it is, we can extrapolate and say, well, likewise, are there 12 months in a year? Notice this, day for a year, hour, month, a conversion across. That being the case, then 1 month is 1/12 of a year, as is 1 hour, 1/12 of a day. Notice this, day for a year. So 1 hour equals 1 month on that principle, or 1 hour equals 30 days because there are 30 days in a Jewish month. Got the idea? 1 hour, therefore, is 30 days. Therefore, a half an hour, and this is where we're coming, brothers and sisters, a half an hour is 1/24 of a day, and on a day for a year principle, a half a month is 1/24 of a year, or 15 days. days. So, one half an hour on a single conversion on a day for a year principle is 15 days. Now, here's the tricky bit. In the time periods of the apocalypse, and if you haven't done this, please do it. It's a fantastic exercise. List all the time periods in the apocalypse, and you will find, brothers and sisters, that some time periods in the apocalypse applying a day for a year principle require a single conversion. A half an hour is 15 days. That's a single conversion. However, the context, and I'm going to write a word on the board here, which is a very important word for those of you who want to do some studies in the area of time periods in the apocalypse. There's a very important word, and it's called decorum. And there's this thing in the book of Revelation that is a principle known as the decorum of the symbol. So when you look at time periods in the book of Revelation, brothers and sisters, some of the time periods require one single conversion. Other time periods require a double conversion. You convert once and then you convert again. It's like zip filing and zip filing to fulfill the appropriateness of decorum. And decorum is appropriateness of behavior. And I want to show you that very quickly, simply I think. But if nothing else, it triggers questions in your mind. Go and study it. Go and do something. Look at it. Challenge it if we will, but do it, brothers and sisters. You will be enriched and you will be rewarded. Now, here is where we do a double conversion. A half an hour is 15 days, a single conversion. We convert again and we turn the days into years. And therefore, we say 15 days equals 15 years. We've gone convert, convert. Are we stretching this? Is this a rubber band that we're pulling back and forth to suit ourselves? No, brothers and sisters, there's an appropriate decorum here. Now, I'll give you a little challenge. We're not too far in our studies. Here's the challenge. If we, in this time period, just taking a day for a year and things are trotting along nice and simply, and we just said, I'll singly convert, because that's the process of a day for a year, and we were to singly convert and say there was silence in heaven for about the space of half an hour, if it was a single conversion, and we're looking at this period, which it is 14 years. In this instance, we've got 15, and I'll show you why we go 15 to 14. But if this was a single conversion, and only a single conversion, we'd read in Revelation 8 and verse 1, and we would read, and there was silence in heaven for about the space of what? 15 days. And we go, oh, that's pretty simple. 15 days, single conversion, day for a year, 15 days equals 15 years. So here's John, if it was going to be a single conversion, and he's riding away and all of a sudden he flips his parchment, he's waiting for the next action and drama, and there's silence. And the silence goes on and on and on and on for 15 days. John can't stand there for 15 days, brothers and sisters, waiting for the next act to come. That is not appropriate decorum. So God then zips it back and says, John can sit there and wait for half an hour. Nothing. And then he writes. That's his appropriate decorum, you see. So that's the basis. Now, if we went through that very quick, you've got the slides. If you haven't heard that before, go and research it. Go and look at it. Think about it. What does it really mean? Let's see how it falls into place. I love this bit because the record doesn't say there was silence in heaven for half an hour. It says about, and that is a very important word because God is saying it is not exactly 15 years or 15 days, it is about. And we therefore submit, brothers and sisters, that that about ends up being 14 years of political silence following the theme and principle from the sixth seal, where it was all about political issues in the empire, and that still spills over in the political heavens in the seventh seal. So we are looking at 14 years, and there it is, silence. And in that silence, brothers and sisters, the angels would begin to prepare to blast these trumpets. What an amazing thing. So there we are. When you look at that, silence in heaven for about the space of a half an hour, it is the 14-year period from the close of the sixth seal to the beginning of the seventh, and it would walk through until Constantine died. And I'll tell you this, when Constantine died, chaos was back again. Chaos that side, silence in there, and chaos was back when Constantine died. So in summary, this period is the peace as a result of Constantine's victory over paganism. So brothers and sisters, on the chart there, on the screen, we have this. There is that section that we are just talking about here. There's the silence in the political heavens for that 14-year period. Over there was the chaos of the sixth seal. Let's put that up on the chart so that stays there with us. So we come over here. Here's all the chaos over here as a result of the sixth seal. And then, of course, we have the silence. And then, brothers and sisters, we looked at this verse very briefly the other day, that when you read Revelation 8 and verse 5, there are thunderings and lightnings. The chaos is back in verse 5. Alrighty, enough of that. How are the heads? Pretty good. Some will be saying, I need to work on this. Some will be saying, I'm not so sure. That works for me. Please go and look and study and research it. See how amazing it really is, brothers and sisters. Alrighty. Now here's something that really also becomes a fundamental principle as we launch into chapter 8. You will notice, brothers and sisters, as we walk through chapter 8, there is this constant theme that pops up through chapter 8 called the third part. I want to highlight that in a minute. Now what happened is when Constantine moved his capital from Rome to Byzantium, later to be called Constantinople in 330, when Constantine in AD 326 moved the seat of his empire to Byzantium, from this time the empire was divided into three parts. That really does set the scene for chapter 8. One third was the Latin West. They spoke Latin, as the name suggests, and their Catholic religion was based on the structure of Diocletian, the pagan emperor. Diocletian, diocese, you hear the echo from pagan Rome into the Catholic system. Over here we had another third part called the Hellenic East. Over in this part of the empire they were Greek-speaking, their religion was very philosophical. This was the area where all the debates between Athanasius and Arius raged. Is Jesus a god? Is Jesus a man? All the infighting with the bishops of Antioch, of Nicodemia, of Constantinople and the like. And then you have here, brothers and sisters, this third of the empire, which is called the Hellenized East. The people that lived in this area were superficially Greek. Very easily swayed, of course, when the Saracens swarmed out of Arabia through Palestine and swarmed up here through North Africa, easily converted these superficial Greek people. Alrighty, now there are our three sections of the empire, just so happens to be there when Revelation 8 brings out this idea of the third part. Well, let's look at it. Here's an excellent little exercise again as far as colouring in is concerned. Now we're looking at the four wind trumpets. And when we have a look at these four trumpets, brothers and sisters, there they are in Revelation 8. The first wind trumpet is there in verse 7. The second wind trumpet is there in verse 8. Likewise, the third wind trumpet in verse 10. And our fourth wind trumpet is there in verse 12. Now notice the consistent emphasis of the third part. What we have in verse 1 is there is a third part of the trees that are going to be burnt up. Now remember, the empire is divided into three parts. When you come to the second wind trumpet, you also see three times used, fire was cast into the sea and a third part of the sea became blood, whatever that means. We'll see that tomorrow. And a third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. And a third part of the ships were destroyed. Again, the emphasis of the third part pops up in verse 10 and 11. So now we've got in verse 10, the third wind trumpet, that a third part of the rivers and waters became, well, they were smitten with this meteor that would fly across the heavens. And then in verse 11, we've got, and the third part of the waters became wormwood. Again, in verse 12, in the fourth wind trumpet, now be careful with this one, in the fourth trumpet, in verse 12, we've got the fourth angel sounded and a third part of the sun was smitten. A third part of the moon also was smitten. and a third part of them was darkened. Now be careful, stop there with that one, and don't colour the last little section where it says, and a third part of it, and the night likewise. The reason you don't colour in that last little section is because that's the time period that this part of the empire was eclipsed. A third part of it was eclipsed, a third part of it was eclipsed, a third part of it was eclipsed for a period of a third part of the day and a third part of the night. Don't get worried about that. We'll talk about that tomorrow. All we need to understand, brothers and sisters, is this section of chapter 8, where it talks about a third, a third, a third, each of these four wind trumpets are blown, and they are particularly and specifically and peculiarly judging the Latin West only. So all the way through chapter 8, it is four barbaric empires, or four barbaric kings, I should say, that would come and do their bit by decimating the Latin West. When you spin across into chapter 9, you're introduced at the end of chapter 8 by three more trumpets. Woe trumpet 1, woe, woe, woe. So three woe trumpets come in, and these three woe trumpets find their place in chapter 9 and chapter 11. See how this idea of a third part continues across. So we've got the first woe trumpet, or the fifth trumpet, here beginning in verse 1 of chapter 9. And this would be Muhammad, and this would be the Saracens. And they, brothers and sisters, would come and lop off that third of the empire. They would decimate the Hellenized East. It then spins across in the latter part of chapter 9, where we see now the sixth trumpet, or the second woe trumpet as it is, and again look at the expression, the third part. Verse 15, to slay the third part of men. Verse 18, by these three, smoke, fire and brimstone, was a third part of men killed. And so, brothers and sisters, you've now got the last third part of the empire that's lopped off. So God systematically, in turn, lops off each one third of the empire as these trumpets blow on the Christian Roman world. What an amazing thing. Now, you're going to get those slides, of course, in colour like that, and they'll have all the fades and pop-ups and what have you. So if we didn't quite all get that down, then you can certainly get that when you, if you so desire, get the memory stick. Alrighty, brothers and sisters, the seven angels prepared themselves to sound. Now, this is a very important expression. They prepared themselves to sound. Now, we need barbarians pressed against the border of the Rhine River, the boundary of the Roman Empire, and we need barbarians pressed against the River Danube for these events of chapter 8 to be fulfilled, you see. And this preparation of these barbarians being squeezed, oh yes, in years and years gone by, barbarians had had incursions over the border, they jumped over the border and then jumped back again, but now they're going to be squeezed, not only come down as hunters, but some of these barbarians are going to come down as refugees and plead to the Romans to help us. And can we come across the border? Well, the preparation, brothers and sisters, was instigated through the Huns. And the Huns, the experts tell us, they're not really sure whether they came way, way, way from the dynasties of China and were forced across, or whether they came from the steppes of Siberia. They certainly came from way, way, way over here in the east. And these Huns coming from the steppes, the non-mountainous, the non-forested grasslands of the steppes of Siberia, would enter into a migration that Germans call the Falcon Wanderer. And as they move, this would be the wanderings of the people. This would be the wanderings of the Huns. And nobody liked the Huns. All the other barbarians, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Alans, the Burgundians, and even the Romans, were frightened of the Huns, brothers and sisters. And as the Huns moved westward, they were pushing and forcing the other German barbarians to also migrate and press against the border of the Roman Empire. Now, Fisher, in his book, The Geography of Europe, or The History of Europe, on page 111, says this about the Huns. He says they were a wild Mongolian people riding on stout ponies out of Central Asia in the latter part of the 4th century. These Mongolian people made their way over the steppes into southeastern Europe, slaying and plundering as they rode these ugly, merciless creatures known as the Huns. You know, brothers and sisters, I picked up a book and it didn't call the Huns humans, it called them dwarf-like creatures with dwarf-like frames on skinny legs. Didn't even call them humans. So these are dwarf-like framed, skinny-legged creatures, you see. And what these Huns used to do, brothers and sisters, is as teenage boys, the Huns used to get knives and sharp rocks and scar their faces so that they wouldn't grow beards when they got older. And when they rode into battle, they used to wear rat skin helmets. So you've got these dwarf-like framed on skinny legs with scarred faces and rat skin helmets. Oh, would you be scared of the Huns? I would be scared of the Huns, brothers and sisters. And the record says in history that the Alans, the Ostrogoths, and the Visigoths felt, well, before we go any further, let's just clear this one up. All of us, well, some of us, maybe none of us, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, now they're all Goths. They all come from Gottenland. So in case you haven't read it in the history or read Asterix, which would probably help you out, you do learn a bit of history, let me tell you, from Asterix, you know? So cut your teeth on Asterix to start with. You know, brothers and sisters, the Visigoths, now again, you've got to have I know there's a couple of German brothers and sisters here, so please forgive me. So for a Visigoth, you want to know the difference. Well, a Visigoth, you're German, you're from the West. West, you're a Westengoth, a Visigoth. So they're Western Goths, you see. Now the Ostrogoths, you're from Ist, you're Eastern. So we've got Eastern Goths and we've got Western Goths. Now here come the Huns. So the Alans and the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths felt successively the force of a thrust, spreading tremors through the whole German world, leading to those great but obscurely chronicled movements of the German peoples, which for a time submerged Gaul, Britain, Spain, Africa and Italy. Brothers and sisters, the Huns are coming. Now I tell you what, these Huns might have been ugly. Ugly as sin, they were. They might have been ugly, brothers and sisters. They might have had scar faces. They might have had dwarf-like frames on skinny legs. They might have wore rat-skin helmets. But I tell you what, it was something about them that the whole world were in admiration of, and that was they could ride. They could ride horses like nobody else could ride. They could actually, brothers and sisters, read a book on their horse, 10 volumes. They could eat a dinner on the horse, 3 courses, 5 courses. You know what it's like. I've seen you eat 8 courses. So here they are on their horses eating all this food. And the Huns could sleep on their horse. They fell asleep on their horses for hours, if not days, as they rode in, brothers and sisters. They were awful people, and they were preparing the way that the trumpets might blow. And so we then begin the first trumpet. Good, time is going well. We're only doing the first trumpet in this section. So, we read therefore in Revelation chapter 8 and verse 7, these words, the preparation is taking place. Now it's the time for the first wind trumpet to blow. So, verse 7, Revelation 8. And the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled in blood, as it should be, and they were cast upon the earth. And a third part of trees, note that, a third part of trees first. And then the grass was burnt up. Now we could go to a number of Old Testament quotations to look at this idea of hail and fire. A good quotation would be Isaiah 28. Let's have a look at it, brothers and sisters. Now as we turn up Isaiah 28, I'd want to impress you with this one fact. In Revelation 8 and verse 7, we have the first time that God is bringing judgment on Christian Rome. The first time we have judgment on Christian Rome, Babylon the Great. Babylon. Now with that in mind, Isaiah 28. Awful chapter. Awful chapter. An awful chapter and an awful calamity that would befall Israel. And so we come to Isaiah 28 and we read these words. Verse 2. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one, which as a tempest of hail, there's our expression, and a destroying storm, as a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with the hand. Now here, brothers and sisters, we've got a hailstorm. God is going to bring hail. God is going to bring war, judgment, to the 10 tribes of the north through the king of Assyria. Why? What had Israel done that was so bad that required a hailstorm to be thrown down upon his people Israel? What had they done? Well, quite frankly, brothers and sisters, they were drunk. And because they were drunk, they were ignorant. Oh, you pick that up in verse 8. All tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so there is no place clean. Whom shall he teach knowledge? These people, brothers and sisters, are ignorant. Knowledge? Don't give me knowledge. And he looks out and he sees tables full of vomit. Who's going to teach knowledge? Who will understand the doctrine? Mature men and women. Not babies. Those that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breasts. And God looks down from heaven and he sees an immature family of God. He sees babies walking around, brethren and sisters, not grown men. Oh, listen to the song these people are singing. Precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. You know, brothers and sisters, Rotherham puts this in prose. This verse in verse 10 is a drunken song. And then you've got the people of Israel, they're staggering around like that. There's places full of vomit. They're staggering around, they're drunk, and they're going, oh, he's going to teach us the word of God. Don't give me too much of the Bible. I just want milk. Don't upset my life. Don't give me meat. I don't want to study the scriptures. And because of that, brothers and sisters, they were drunk with the doctrine of Babylon. In Isaiah's day, Ephraim had corrupted them through the doctrine of Babylon, and the effects were devastating. Look at verse 17. Here were the effects that came upon God's people, and look at the connection to Revelation 8, you see. Judgment, verse 17. This is the effect of ignorance through drunkenness of the doctrines of the day. Judgment also will I lay to the lion, and righteousness to the plumber. Here's your expression. The hail shall sweep away. Notice this. The refuge of lies. The waters shall overflow. The hiding place. Here were the people of God, supposedly, who had now found a refuge in a lie. Babylon. Falsehood became the people of God's hiding place because of Babylon. That's 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. When the man of sin would come, God would send a strong delusion that they might believe a lie. Oh, brothers and sisters, that's just touching the surface. Do ourselves a favour. Look at the connections between this section and the section, of course, in Revelation chapter 8. Well, we don't have time for that, but all we do, probably, yes, probably a minute. Yeah, that's okay. When this destruction would come, brothers and sisters, through, in this first instance, Alaric and his band of Visigoths, as we'll show you in about a 3-minute jaunt through history, this third part of the trees, a third part of the Latin Empire, trees, brothers and sisters, are elevated vegetation, grass. All people are as the grass. So we've now got here in symbol, and we can justify that by looking at Judges 9, which we will briefly mention. So a third part of the tree, so Alaric is going to come down and deal with the leaders and rulers of this Christian empire, and then all of the common people in the Latin West are going to feel the devastation of the ravages of this barbarian from the north. We don't need to turn it up, but you know Judges 9 pretty well, I think, and you certainly would know Judges chapter 8. Do you remember Judges 8 where the people went to Gideon and said, would you be our king? Gideon said, no, I won't be your king. I will nourish you, but I won't be your king. And so therefore, there was a man, Abimelech, who was the son of Gideon to a concubine, and Abimelech really wanted to be the king. And he got hold of this mob of cutthroats and brigands, and he went and he slew these 70 sons, his 70 half-brothers. Do you know the story in Judges chapter 9? But of course, Jotham, the youngest son of Gideon, escaped. And when he escaped, he then scrambled up on top of Mount Gerizim, and he looked down and he uttered a parable as the men of Milo and as the men of Shechem were assembled around Abimelech and they're about to make him king. And Jotham screams down from the top of Gerizim and said, to the men of Milo and the men of Shechem, you trees. He calls them, who had responsibility to elect a king, he calls them trees. He said, you went to the vine and he wouldn't be your king, that was Gideon. You went to the olive tree, he wouldn't be your king, that was Gideon. You went to the fig tree, he wouldn't be your king, that was Gideon. But you went to the bramble, which was Abimelech. So you see in Judges chapter 9, brothers and sisters, trees are elevated men, men in responsibility. Well, this is what Alaric's going to do to the Catholic system or the West, the third part. So, just to wrap up our study, let's just show you how this works and show you what an amazing thing that's mentioned as far as history is concerned. And really, the angels just tapping some of these historical writers on the back and saying, make sure you put that word in there. You'll see what I mean. Now, brothers and sisters, the Visigoths, there's Alaric. First wind trumpet. Now, don't think that the Visigoths, when they first came down, were these great big scary things that had these big helmets with horns coming out and they're out to kill everybody in their path. You know, to start with, it wasn't like that. These Visigoths were just farmers. They just wanted to be left alone. They had families, they had children, they just wanted to just pasture. They just wanted to just do their own thing, worship their own pagan gods, look after their children, and they were living around this area here. But the Huns were coming. And the Huns were going to create awful devastation to the Visigoths. The Huns would take them as slaves, you see. And so this forced the Visigoths to come down to this area and be pressed against the Danube River. And as they were being pressed, they had to make a choice. We're Visigoths. We've got kids. We've got wives. What are we going to do? We're going to stay this side of the Danube River and we're going to risk the brutality of the Huns and be taken into slavery? Or will we come across the Danube River and appeal to the Christian Romans? Now, if we do that, we're going to have to be subservient to the Christian God. We're going to have to be subservient to the Roman Emperor. We're going to have to walk and work in the Roman army and be subservient to people over us who are Romans. What do we do? Well, of course, there's no choice. They couldn't stay there and be absolutely devastated by the Huns, and so they came across. Well, they appealed to the Emperor, the Christian Emperor in Constantinople, the Emperor Valens. And they said to the Emperor, can we come across, please? We'll come across, we'll behave ourselves. And the Emperor Valens said, yes, you can, but he showed his authority. The Emperor Valens said, you can come, you group can come, you group can stay on the other side. He was just showing that he was in charge and just to lay the line in the sand. Besides which, brothers and sisters, if Valens had too many Visigoths coming across, he'd have to feed them. And if he had too many Visigoths coming across, they could usurp and they could rebel. So he only let a few come across. And so a few brothers and sisters came across. But Valens said, stay there. Don't go wandering around the place. Stay just over the river. We'll feed you. You can come into our army and we'll look after you. Well, they didn't. It was awful. These were asylum seekers. These were refugees. And they came across, brothers and sisters, and the captains and the generals of the army on the River Danube treated them like absolute animals. They didn't feed them. What they did was they went around trying to find as many stray dogs and wild dogs as they could, these Romans, and they cut them up and they were giving pieces of dog meat to the Visigoths in exchange for their children as slaves. You don't do that to barbarians. It won't work all the time. And so what happened, brothers and sisters, the Visigoths revolted. And a hungry person fighting is a very, very potent warrior. And so they fought a battle and Valens went to war and Valens was killed. And the world held their breath because here was the most devastating defeat of the Roman army at the hand of the Visigoths. Well, Valens went and in came the great general Theodosius, brothers and sisters. And Theodosius struck a bargain with the Visigoths. He said, here you go, I'll give you that territory up there. There's your concentration camp, stay there. That did not work. Theodosius died and his two sons, respectively, Arcadius in Constantinople, Honorius in Rome, took their roles as rulers. And Arcadius said to the Visigoths, there's a pay cut in the army. Any Visigoth soldier, money's cut. And besides which, no promotion for Visigoths. And Arcadius was going to starve them to death and get rid of them once and for all. Well, they revolted, brothers and sisters, and they grabbed Alaric at this stage, whacked him on top of their shield, and in come the Visigoths to Constantinople to get him. Well, they couldn't take Constantinople. It was impregnable at this stage. So they were all pumped full of adrenaline. So round about face went the Visigoths, and they went charging into Macedonia. And when they did, they hit a brick wall. And the brick wall was a great general called Stilicho. He was half a barbarian. He knew how to deal with barbarians. And so he kicked the barbarians, the Visigoths, out, brothers and sisters. Well, a few years later, Alaric's back in 402, and he's come into Milan. Guess what? Stilicho's there. He's everywhere. And so Stilicho kicked them out. Well, Stilicho, brothers and sisters, was a tall poppy. You know, tall poppy in a vase stands out. Best thing to do is to make the vase look even. Trim him off. Snip him off. Well, his own men bumped him off. The only man that could control barbarians, brothers and sisters, and they bumped him off, and that let the floodgates go. In came a swarm of barbarians in 406. Alaric wasn't there. He was over here waiting, and in he came. So, brothers and sisters, he came down to Milan, then he came down to Rome in 408. For the first time in 800 years, Rome had barbarians banging at her gate. And Alaric sat around the city and waited and waited and waited. And inside the city of Rome, the people starved and starved and starved, and they began to eat their children. That was Jerusalem in AD 70 revisited. What the Romans did to the Jews, Alaric was now doing to the Romans. And the people said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I need money, I need land, I need pasture, I need recognition. Give it to me." So they threw a whole pile of money at him and he went away. The year later, he was back again in 409. They said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I didn't get the recognition. I didn't get the land. You're treacherous. You've been treacherous to the Visigoths for decades. I want recognition. I want farmland. I want my children and families to grow up in peace." Well, they gave him more money and said, "Go over there." He went away and he came back the next year in 410. They said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I want more." And they said, "We've got none to give you." He said, "Well, I'll stay." And brothers and sisters, when he finally took Rome, did Alaric, when he finally took Rome, it wasn't like in AD 70 where they climbed over a staircase of dead bodies that had been thrown out of the city. Someone in Rome had opened up a gate and let the Goths in. You don't tell me the angels were working? Oh, yes, they were. An angel whispered to somebody in Rome and said, "At midnight, open the Salarian gate." There were angels there, brothers and sisters. Look at this. Here's Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It's what he says about Alaric. "Alaric marched to the gates of Rome. At the hour of midnight, the Salarian gate was silently opened. And the inhabitants of Rome were awakened by the tremendous sound of the Gothic trumpet." Trumpet? This is the first wind trumpet of the apocalypse, brothers and sisters. "And Alaric himself said this about himself." He was an Arian Christian, didn't believe in the Trinity. "Alaric said, 'It is not of mine own will that I do this. There is one who forces me on and will not let me rest, bidding me spoil Rome.'" What an amazing thing, brothers and sisters. That's just the surface of it all. And we don't have time to read through this. And all we read in Revelation and chapter 8 is the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled in blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the Latin third, the rulers of the Latin third, and all the people of the Latin third were burnt up by this barbarian that was fed up with the treachery of Christian Rome. What an amazing thing. Well, God willing, tomorrow morning we finish our study, and we'll finish on an exhortational note, brothers and sisters, we draw all these things together. But tomorrow we'll look at the last three wind trumpets under the heading, "The Western Empire is Eclipsed." Thank you.